Okay.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thank you for listening. This is Chris Campbell from the Little John Centre in the on your screen, and Robert Cartwright from the Institute of Classical Osteopathy. We'd like to do a presentation today about a publication that was in the Journal of the American Osteopathic Association from 1912, and it was a hypothetical case history asking readers to what their interpretation of it and how they would go about treating it.
Okay, it's in the, for those who want to get the original, it's in the August 1912 Journal of the American Osteopathic Association. So.
Okay, so let's I'll just share the screen so we can here we go. Hold shift to set. There we go. And go to slideshow. Play from start. Now, can you see that okay, Chris?
Yes, that's fine. So this is what was called Symposium on Technique, as Robert has said. And it was the idea was that to get osteopaths talking again about different approaches. And as you probably know back then and even today, there's a lot of angst between different approaches in osteopathy. And they wanted to try and get a debate going to get osteopathy more unified. And not necessarily towards one specific technique or approach, but as a comprehensive approach into healing and to treating disease. So these are the osteopaths that were involved that replied. There's Ella Still, graduated in the ASO in 1897. Jay Hodgkin, from the Northern Institute in around 1899. Bryant from Chicago, that would be Little John's College, the American College of Osteopathic Medicine and Surgery, 1903. Joseph Sullivan, the Kirksville again, 1896. McNichol, ASO again, Kirksville, 1898. Thomas Ray, again from Kirksville in 1898. Winbigler from Philadelphia College in 1902. McBain's, Kirksville, 1901. Frawley, Kirksville again, 1902. And Fisk in Kirksville, 1904. And then Gamble is again from Kirksville in 1900. So it's quite a range of osteopaths, all of whom would have had good exposure to A.T. Still. A lot of them, when Still would have still been the main teacher in Kirksville. Others from places like Philadelphia and the Northern Institute, which would have had people like Mason Presley in Philadelphia. And all of them would have had some exposure, if not in Kirksville, through publications with Little John. So it's quite a good group, and it's well worth looking at. Okay.
And Mason Presley, if I remember rightly, was the physiology professor before Little John, wasn't he?
He was there. He was supposed to take up the professorship of physiology when he had to leave under a cloud, nothing to do
Oh,
with
yes, I remember. Yeah.
that.
Okay, let's go to the next one. So the patient, this is a hypothetical case history. And devised by the journal authors. It's a female patient, aged between 35 to 40. She's married. She has two or three children. The youngest is about 10 years old, and she has a good family history as to regards to general health, but not so good as to her nervous system, and reveals what they call some evidence of a neurotic taint. We'll be discussing that later. But in appearance, the patient is slight, appears highly strung, sallow, and indicates a sluggish liver and poor glandular activity. She reports little bodily vigor, so she's very gets exhausted readily, and has severe headaches. And in her earlier life, suffered much with prolapsus uteri. And though she has not suffered severely from pelvic disorders in recent years, she gets the occasional bout of cystitis, and she complains of severe pain at the root of her neck, so at the sort of cervicodorsal region, and also around her waistline, and sometimes pain, severe pain in her leg.
It's an interesting case history, and the first thing that strikes me about it is, if this walked into most current osteopaths' practices, what would they do?
Yes.
The question to ask, would you take it on, or would you send for tests, or what would you do? And to compare that with the attitude of osteopaths back in the day when osteopathy practiced real medicine, in my view. Right, let's have a look and see.
So
examination showed.
The examination showed a severe twist in her mid-cervical and a curvature of the muscles in that region, and a lateral deviation at the first and second dorsal, posterior in the lower dorsal and upper lumbar, with a lateral swerve to the right in this region, which is a relatively typical presentation mechanically of people. Muscles of the lumbar on this side were tense, and the right innominate was pulled up with a twist of the pelvis. So that could demonstrate this sort of anterior rotation that we see on the right-hand side of the pelvis, or some kind of upshunt from a trauma at some point. And she had one heel extending below the other, at least 1 inch, when the patient is supine on the table. So if it's when she's supine on the table, that might indicate it's more of a physiological leg length difference rather than anatomical. Her abdominal muscles were flaccid, and there was no evidence of any action in respiration. The lower ribs sagged and were rigid, so it sounds like with this posterior drift of her thoracic spine, her diaphragm had flattened as well. She had a moderate dilation of the stomach and some ptosis of the abdominal viscera, and she was usually constipated. Blood reveals moderate secondary anemia. Her heart and lungs were negative, or there was no obvious evidence of a problem there, and her reflexes were normal. The local examination eliminated any cystocele or any as a complicating factor in cystitis, and the urine analysis was negative for sugar or albumin, and there was no evidence of any serious systemic condition. And we see people like this who go through the medical model, and they're told that there's nothing wrong with them, but they're clearly quite unwell. So this
it's a good thing to get just take pause for a second and think, okay, picture this woman coming into your office, and this is the story that she's told you, and this is what you find. What are you going to do? What is your approach? What's your whole modus operandi with this patient? And just hold that in your mind now while we go and look at what these osteopaths from 1912 had to say.
And again, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's 1912, but they're doing blood tests, they're doing urine analysis, they've done a cardiovascular examination, a respiratory examination, a pelvic examination, and neurological examination, as well as blood tests and urine analysis. So it's pretty complete.
Yeah. So the question that they were asked is very simple. How do you treat this case?
So they are would...
There are disturbances of the innominate and of the vertebra at least 3 points. So he's pointing them in a direction as to what questions and what way he wants them to look at the case here. Do you work at all four lesions, all four of these lesion areas at the same time, and you treat the case, which practically means what they call a general treatment, where so many centers are to be manipulated? And if so, how frequently do you feel justified in treating the case? And this leads into the debates that were going on about general treatment versus specific treatment, which were endemic at the time and still today. But one point you should always bear in mind when thinking of that is these osteopaths, a lot of them graduated in 1898, 1897, when still was the primary teacher. The debate about general treatment started way back then with people like Gravett, who graduated in 1897, 1898, well before Little John or anybody else came along. So this whole debate about what is the general treatment is fundamental. It goes right back to the beginning of osteopathy. And the teachers at that time were Still's children, Still himself, and people like Hildreth. So it's got nothing to do with Little John, this debate about general versus specific. Little John added a different dimension to it, but we'll come back to that. Anyway, I digressed a bit there, Robert. Do you want to go on then?
Yeah.
About that.
Okay, so, right, so the approach.
No, the question, I haven't finished the question yet.
Mute myself. Let's go back. There we go. Okay, yes, so, yes, they were asked if they were going to work on all four lesions at the same time when you treat the case, as Chris was saying, or do you undertake to correct all of the lesions in the course of the treatment but give attention to one or two of them one at a time or the others at next? And if so, how would you decide which order to do them in? Or do you decide that one of the lesions is causative and correct that and leave the others to correct themselves? Or do you treat the lesions which seem to cause the symptoms which the woman is complaining of directly and leave the others to sort them out when they become troublesome? I mean, is that even a something you could do?
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, it's the graduation from what they call a general treatment to specific, doing working in all different areas of the spine, or the looking for the sequencing in terms of which causing trouble, and
yes.
And then see the reaction,
yeah.
And so
yeah.
on. There's different layers of approach, which they're still around today, all the same layers. Or the last one, maybe being looking at maybe the hole in one, find the key lesion, and everything else sort itself out.
That other approach, sequencing, which is interesting as well, isn't it? Because there appeared to be several groups of approaches at Kirksville around the latter part of the 19th century, and with people like Little John and Still, who often would use a whole body general treatment, and who stated that you had to approach the patient with reverence, the human body was nature's or God's greatest creation. Or you had the people like Charlie Still and some of his colleagues who were treating 80, 90 people a day and having competitions to see how many people they could see in a day, which was more the hole-in-one type of approach, or sequencing, just manipulating one lesion and then in and out the door quite quickly, rather than treating them with more reverence.
It's a debate which could be happening even today about these different approaches as to which one you do and why.
Yeah.
And so let's see what the people at the time, what approaches they took. Now, we've divided this into two parts. The first one looking at the whole idea of their approach in terms of osteopathy, and then into other things that they have said around the patient.
So this was Ella Still. She was a relative of Still's, or did she marry into the Still family, Chris?
S.S. Still.
Okay, and that was his wife or daughter?
Mom's college, yeah.
Yeah. So she said, my method is to do a little adjustive work in the innominate region, supplemented by light work in the cervical region. In addition to this, some direct treatment to the liver and abdominal areas. So she's encompassing quite a broad sort of approach here. And she says, my idea for working on the lower region first is in accordance with the advice I received from the old doctor, in other words, Andrew Taylor Still, many years ago, which I found very valuable. He used to tell us, if we were to stack up a pile of plates, we would have to put the bottom one down first and be sure that it was level. Which makes sense, doesn't it? For upon that depended the regularity of the rest. I would do some work on the cervical region at the first treatment, because obviously that there's quite a lot going on through the cervical region, and that's obviously going to be involving the cerebro spinal nervous system there, and I assume she's taking that into consideration in because of the neurasthenia. And through this area, I can reach the head and the pneumogastric nerve, which also supplies so many of the viscera. So obviously, he was talking about the ptosis of the stomach and the sluggish liver as well.
It's interesting in the quote there about still. I mean, Wernham used to say this about Little John all the time. He said, "What's the point in working on the roof if your foundations are wrong?" Same principle. And the idea of working on the bottom first, on the foundation first, and then going up to the cervical, is that if you get a reaction, you're going to get the biggest reaction at the top, because it's got the most sway. And if you do a little bit on the bottom, the top is going to get more reaction. So it's she's thinking mechanically, even though she hasn't put that laid down a systematic mechanical approach to it. And I like the idea she uses the word a little adjustment. She isn't going in there and hammering and hoping to get it all done in one treatment. She's very respectful, it comes across in that. Just a little bit about her before we go on, if you want to go to the next slide. Just telling you a little bit about her, that she was chair of descriptive anatomy in Kirksville and one of the regular operators in the Still Infirmary in 1897. And then she moved to Des Moines in 1898 to found the Des Moines College of Osteopathy with her husband, and I love his name, Dr. Summerfield Saunders Still, who's a nephew of A.T. Still. I love that name.
They do have some fantastic names, don't they, some of these people?
And if you know in history, she was a third cousin of the poet Longfellow. I don't know whether that's got anything to do with it. She was a champion of osteopathic obstetrics and believed that mothers should be the happiest creatures on earth and be able to look upon motherhood as a blessing rather than a curse, realizing that the hand that rocks the cradle is the hand that rules the world. From the osteopathic standpoint, most of the suffering in childbirth was unnecessary. And the school in Des Moines then came back under the Kirksville's management in about 1903-4. So she worked a lot in Kirksville, and she had this wonderful reputation in obstetrics. Her approach has just been to that. I mean, I think says it all, you know, that most of the suffering in childbirth and so on is unnecessary, osteopathically. Aside.
And also interesting, again, as a slight aside, that she was a woman graduating from what would be seen as a medical institution in 1897, and considered very highly. There was no kind of difference in parity between men and male and female practitioners back then, it would appear, and
No,
hopefully
it's
there
one
isn't
of the
now.
features of osteopathy in from Still and Little John that they're all seen as equal. No difference at all. So, who's next?
So then we have J. Hodgson, who was from the Northern Institute, and we think in 1899. And he said that I should first endeavour to locate the primary lesion and consider myself lucky if I succeeded, which is an interesting comment in itself, isn't it? In addition to specific work, I think a constitutional or general treatment is indicated here. I realize that I'm in danger of being considered a back number and very unscientific when I advocate general treatment. I've heard many argue against it and I have read much opposed to it, but 13 years' experience has only fortified my faith in it. I know it has been used, like charity, to cover a multitude of sins and whole mountains of ignorance, but I am convinced that in a fair proportion of my cases, general treatment is indicated. So that's very interesting, isn't it? Because he's talking about general treatment and specific treatment together.
It is. It's a good way he calls the general treatment a constitutional treatment, which in Little John defined a specific approach as a constitutional treatment. And it's taking that term general treatment and making it more specific. And this idea in there with it of going and finding the so-called primary or the key lesion and working on it to unlock the whole, two different, almost two ends of the spectrum together.
It's almost a little bit mixed up there, isn't it, really? And I guess he would be thinking that he could unlock that, but also articulate everything, which would perhaps reduce the afferent bombardment into the spinal cord and the dorsal horn to reduce some of these massive bombardment into her central nervous system from her periphery. And I think one of the problems with general treatment, or the understanding of general treatment, which we still have today, is that it's just articulating everything and hoping for the best, which seems to be what he's concerned about, rather than the really specific body adjustment that we use now.
Okay, let's see who have we got next? Right.
Ah, Fryett. So he graduated from Chicago in 1903, which was so he would have been training under the Little Johns, and as well as McConnell, I think, was at and Smith. I think they were all in Chicago from the onset, weren't
No, not Smith,
they?
but
Okay. The first thing I do in every case is to examine the innominates. And by the way, I never saw a case of neurasthenia without innominate lesions. The case referred to had a right innominate pulled up with a resulting right lumbar curve, which would mean that there was a left dorsal tension and a right cervical tension compensatory to the innominate lesion. I would work on the innominates, then the lumbar, then the dorsal, then the cervical in the order named at each treatment. This is not a general treatment, as the term general treatment is usually used, but it is specific because every lesion is treated specifically and the case as a whole is treated specifically. The patient would improve if the innominates only were corrected, and the superstructure would probably have a quite a tendency to normalize in time without treatment, provided that the innominates could be kept corrected, and provided further that the spinal lesions were not ankylosed. And if all the spinal lesions were helped carefully into line at each treatment, the case would recover more quickly.
it's interesting to compare that one, a different mechanical approach, to that of LSD Still, where she worked on the bottom first and then went to the furthest point away from it. He's taking his adjustment in the bottom in the pelvis and following it up through the spine. And it's very clear in his description of that this is not the general treatment as generally used. And it's very much about Little, same as Little John, which you'd expect, that he's doing very specific work, but taking the whole in each case.
This is very much like an early description of a body adjustment type of approach, rather than the general treatment that we've just been talking about. That would be an approach where you articulate everything, but you'd still have the if you go through it and just articulate everything, you'd still have the same lesion pattern through the whole structure. Whereas if you take this approach that Fryett is talking about, it's hopefully reducing the lesion pattern, and therefore reducing this aberrant influx of information into the spinal cord and central nervous system.
Okay. Now, who's next? Another great osteopath, Joseph H. Sullivan, who is a very close friend of Still, worked in Chicago, took over one of Still's son's practices in Chicago. He had the office in the same building as Little John. He was on, I think, the fifth floor as Little John was up higher. Oh, let's see.
He said, "I should treat most marked lesions first, disregarding whether they were primary or secondary. I have not as yet accepted the compensatory lesion idea. In fact, I have disproven the idea to my satisfaction. I should want such a case at least 3 months twice a week and fix the worst lesions first, whether cervical or lumbar."
There's two interesting points there. I mean, he's very, very specific in what he's doing, very, very specific. But also, compared to what a lot of osteopaths do now, if you look at the length of time he's treating, it's the same as what Still used to say. I mean, he said to Gravett and to others that don't expect anything for at least 6 months in terms of your symptoms getting better. It takes time. It takes time. 3 months, twice a week. All of them had the similar type approach back then. It nature takes time. Mm. That's, it's a very simple case, mm. but he's very, very specific in what he's doing. Mm. There was another, I'm not sure if it was Sullivan or somebody of the same time period as him, who said in one of their letters in one of the journals that you, when debating about the general treatment, saying you have to treat specifically and only takes 5 to 10 minutes. Mm. And if the patient wants to feel that they're getting their money's worth, then you can give them a general treatment afterwards. Mm. Just as an aside. And there's a bit of that in the thinking at that time as well. Mm. You know, anyway, it's an interesting, so far, the three different approaches of what that we've had so far.
I wonder how he managed to prove to himself that the compensatory lesion idea.
Well, he disregarded it from what I see there. He took the most prominent lesion, don't care whether it's primary or secondary, let's take that, then the next. Mm. And there's a bit of that whole idea of sequencing.
What's causing
the most disturbance? Mm. Correct that, see what happens, whether you're doing it in one treatment or over several treatments.
Yeah. There we go.
And same as what Wernham used to say, mm. each treatment is a new diagnosis. You do a treatment. You bring that treatment into the next treatment and see how it's responded and see what's thrown up next, and then you work with that. But Wernham's idea was not so much looking at specific individual lesions, but the body as a whole and the individual lesions within that.
Mm. So next up we had Ella McNichol from Frankfort, Indiana, who graduated from the American School of Osteopathy, which would have been under Steele and Little John, I think, at that point in 1898.
Just come in after she graduated.
Mm. And she says, I incline to think the innominate lesion, the primary one, if the right limb is short. You have it in ample cause for right lumbar curve. If this lesion does not antedate her 20th year, the curvature will yield with very little assistance after the correction of the innominate. I should follow up my innominate adjustment with a loosening of the lumbar and lower dorsal area. My next effort would be directed at the cervical adjustment and from that to the upper dorsal. I should work on these lesions at each treatment in order named, grading my work in accordance with condition of the patient. The innominate lesion is one of the easiest of correction I have to deal with, and one with far-reaching effects.
Which is sort of not quite following the same line as Fryatt suggested, without going into the same detail. But I think you had an observation about the arches in that, and the pyramids in the way that she was approaching it.
Hmm. And of course, the idea of the pyramids does predate this by quite a way, doesn't it? It was in some of Steele's early anatomy books, as well as then developed by Henry.
Mm. Right now, then, as you're looking at that lumbar dorsal area, then going back down to the upper dorsal in terms of the different arches and the pyramids and the stress lines.
Mm.
Again, it's the one bit that did make me smile was the innominate lesion being one of the easiest in correction. I'm not sure how many people would agree with that. Anyway,
it's interesting, isn't it? You know what, and of course it all depends on what you've been exposed to. You know, maybe she'd seen a lot that have been easy to do, whereas others, they can be very, very difficult and stubborn.
But I do think Ian Shea's right. It's one of the ones that has the most far-reaching effect. So even if you get a little change in it, you can have a huge effect.
Yeah, yeah. And as you're saying, you know, further up, you know, the better you get the pelvis, the less deviation there will be higher up, and less disturbance there will be through the autonomic system, and particularly into the neck, where, you know, the cerebrospinal nervous system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so who's next? Thomas L. Ray, graduate from Kirksville.
Yeah. Yeah, but in 1998 again, so he might have got a little John, a little bit of Little John, but a lot of Still. And he said the treatment should be administered 3 times a week, and barring great fatigue, we would make an effort to adjust each lesion at each treatment. The fatigue from the treatment can be reduced to a minimum by making no effort to adjust under resistance of the patient. So not forcing the issue. Time spent in getting the patient to become passive is of much service in securing adjustment with a minimum of fatigue to the patient and small effort on our part. It is almost impossible to adjust a spinal lesion under resistance. I would agree with that. In case the patient tires easily under the adjustive treatment of one lesion, give a loosening or a preparatory treatment at each of the other irregularities or lesioned areas, I assume he means there.
Again, it's looking at him, that he's giving just a description of his approach. It doesn't cover everything in it, but it's a different, slightly different point of view in number of treatments compared to what we might people might do today. Is that, again, it takes a lot of treatment, a lot of time, and too often I think we under-treat patients, get rid of some of the superficial symptoms, and we leave it at that, going deep. Other times we over-treat, but that's another story. But this idea of, as you say, no strain, I mean, Little John and Wernham were absolutely insistent on that. You cannot adjust, you cannot force. Just under strain. And Little John went further with this idea of getting the patient to become passive. He wanted them to become actively passive, so they accept the treatment, accept the new rhythm that's going in with the treatment.
That's interesting, isn't it? I remember reading Louisa Burns as well, and she was very adamant about not forcing acute lesions, because you're forcing all the fluids through a capillary bed, which would cause more damage than help.
Yeah, this is true.
Okay.
So we've got Mr. Wynn Bigler, and I put a question mark under him there, but that's just, I forgot to change that. He graduated from the Philadelphia College.
Okay, so he said, in such a case, it would probably be best to work generally to secure a thorough relaxation, and if the condition is favourable, make the adjustments as rapidly as the case will permit. So that's allowing for a bit of sort of practitionership there, really, isn't it? My rule in treating cases of this kind is to secure a thorough relaxation, and then if there are several adjustments to be made, make one, and if the patient is in a good, cheerful state of mind, make another. It is better, I find, to do this than to be too strenuous in the treatment and produce in the mind of the patient a revolt, which will certainly lead to tension and bad feelings for the time. The physical lesions must be removed, luxated vertebra must be adjusted, and any slips of the innominates must be replaced, and a good mental attitude of the patient be established before permanent health will be enjoyed.
He's giving a very thorough explanation of the approach, but again, until you see somebody working, you don't know how he puts it into practice, but and not too strenuous. Work with the patient and get the patient to work with you. You know, get the relaxation first before you try and make the adjustment, and do it in this word generally. Work generally first. Doesn't necessarily mean just giving a good massage. It means getting the patient on your side, making them comfortable with the treatment. And that the last bit is pure osteopathy. You're going to get health. The physical lesions must be removed, it looks like it must be adjusted, and so on. We have to recognize them and the depth of them. And that's what we aim at. There was a debate in the osteopathic physician around that time as well about, are you a lesion osteopath? And Little John's attitude was very straightforward on it. There's no such thing as anything other than a lesion osteopath. If you don't believe in the lesion, you're not an osteopath.
No,
and hit.
No, and that's as true today as it was then.
Anyway, let's go on and see what McBaines has to say.
So he graduated from the American School of Osteopathy a little bit later than some of the others in 1901, but still very early, still heavily influenced by Still, but by that time. The Little John brothers and McConnell had moved on to Chicago. He says, this condition cannot be corrected without work at all the points affected. I believe we could point to no one of the lesions and say that it is causing the trouble. This case would require a general treatment with special attention given to each lesion. I should treat the patient twice a week and work with the idea of correcting each lesion at every treatment.
But again, it's just pure little John and pure still. I mean, that the general approach, or the whole body approach, the body adjustment approach, special attention. And I love the way he puts this, the idea of correcting each lesion. You offer it to each treatment, each lesion. You're not going in and insisting on doing it at each treatment. Very, very. And he would have had a fair bit of little John in his as well as of still.
Again,
this idea, we don't say, here's the offending lesion, let's attack it. What's its position? What's its home that is living in, that is created around it? And we have to work our way to it, take in its effect in the whole body, work from the point that's least affected, is what we're in, say, back to the point that's causing the trouble. That idea in each treatment, and then see how you can progress that from one treatment to the next, and then saying again, how often or how long? The important ones.
Yes, giving a little bit more time there, isn't he? Twice a week rather than three times a week, which some of them who are doing the more sequencing or specific adjustment type stuff. So he's allowing Mother Nature to have a little bit longer between treatments.
It's hard to judge that from in a hypothetical case. All of them are giving more time to the patient, not just saying, okay, I work this way, so you can come once a week. Hang on a minute, it needs more than that. And after 6 weeks, six treatments, right, okay, go away. No, it needs more than that.
So then we've got Edgar.
Wonderful name.
It is, Edgar Quigley Thorley. He qualified in 1902 at the American School of Osteopathy again. And so he says, the case you describe, aside from secondary and lesser lesions, presents the primary causative lesion, innominate luxation, which in its malposition changes the relationship of all the dependent structures and is directly responsible in the conditions of tipped pelvis, swerve of spine, tense muscles, apparent asymmetry in legs, in length of legs, etc. And indirectly through reflexes from irritation, caused by contractures, congestion and atony of soft tissues responsible for much of the trouble. The innominate is to the body what the keystone is to the arch. Fascinating point, that, isn't it? I would treat this patient about three times a week, and each treatment would consist of manipulations to the innominate and all other produced lesions associated with soreness and partial or complete loss of joint motion. Whether the lesion be primary or secondary, though, I would pay special attention to what I believe to be the primary lesions. I also would manipulate the bowels for some time at each treatment till they get to functioning. Nice bit of a Western American verbiage there, really, till they get to functioning. But that's a really fascinating description of what he's doing there, with a good description of the mechanics, how he would approach it, the reflex effects on the nervous system, and how he's thinking of how the mechanics will affect that.
It is. It brings both the mechanics and physiology together. Again, in graduating in 1902, he'd have had maybe a little bit of Little John and Little John's physiology coming into it, but. It's a good description. I mean, okay, this saying that the primary lesion is innominate goes back to what Ella Still was saying, from what A.T. Still said about getting your foundation right, laying that first plate down correctly. There's a lot in it, and I'm bringing in, as you say, the visceral somatovisceral reflexes.
And the comment, the innominate is to the body what the keystone is to the arch.
Yeah, that's a beautiful comment. The keystone of the whole body.
Yeah. So it's really starting to think about the mechanics there. There we go. So
Fisk.
he was from the air, so a little bit later again in 1904. And he says, I believe this matter should be discussed only after a thorough understanding of the terms general and specific. My idea of a general treatment is one which the manipulations employed are given without a definite object in view for each manipulation, or in which the manipulations employed are not directed towards any one specific articulation or organ at a time.
And this is the old definition of what a general treatment was: take every joint through its physiological range of motion as far as possible. Is it?
Just wobbling everything, giving it everything a good shake and hoping for the best.
Gravatt gave an example of when he was treating a patient and Still came in to watch him. He gave a general treatment and he looked over to Still and he didn't applaud him or say anything. So he went through the whole thing again, this time including all the fingers and the toes and everything. And Still said, the patient came for osteopathy, I'd better give him some. Anyway, that's what his description of what the general treatment was often used as, is this, is that, no specific aim.
A specific tr he says the Fisk goes on to say, a specific treatment is one in which the manipulations employed are given with a definite idea in mind for each manipulation or where each manipulation is, with a definite idea directed towards one definite articulation or organ. A specific treatment then could conceivably be one in which each and every accessible articulation and each and every accessible organ in the body receive attention and consume perhaps as long as an hour of time. While a general treatment would conceivably consist of one or more wrenches of the body in some part, directed to no particular articulation or organ and consuming perhaps 5 seconds of time, I think there can be no generalization. Each case is a law unto itself, and a physician's ability to is made evident by his interpretation of the individual's needs. The physician who would attempt to limit himself to any one routine is no longer a physician but a mere manipulator, and his advice becomes practically valueless for those who hold the good of the individual patient above the showing of how patients are treated daily.
This is gets the heart of the debate between specific and general treatment. One point I just take up there, I mean, this limiting practitioner limits up to one routine is a bit different from what Wernham's description of routine. Routine done with a definite blueprint in mind and done with full attention leads you into the world of rhythm. Whereas he's talking about just a routine, okay, patient comes in, crack here, out, or rub this, then crack this, then out. It's a routine without any blueprint behind it, without any interpretation behind it. But I do like the idea, this whole idea that you can't discuss anything without what does general mean, what does specific mean.
And at parts of this, it looks like his specific treatment is a bit like a general treatment, dealing with everything specifically.
More like the term that you we use, the body adjustment, body back to itself.
There we go.
Now we have Mr. Gamble. Now,
Okay.
again, this is one of the problems I have in trying to find out who these people were, is there's a lot of misprints and the some of the lists of graduates from different places have got a lot of errors in it. Like the alumni of the of Kirksville, has got a lot of errors in it. I couldn't find a HW Gamble, only or HM Gamble, only a HW. And from everything I read about him, it seemed to be the same person. So anyway, graduated ASO 1900.
So again, he would have had a lot of influence from Still. He would have been there while Little John was, and McConnell and Smith as well, some of the more the academic lecturers. And he said, I aim to adjust every lesion so far as possible at each treatment and cannot pr approve any other method. I hate to see our practitioners drop into the rut of general treatments, but through no matter what the lesion may be, nor how specific the adjustment may be, the patient generally will receive benefit and satisfaction from general treatment, with the operator keeping in mind an aim, an object in every manipulation. So we're getting towards a more specific general treatment again here, like akin to body adjustment.
It's a bit contradictory in that paragraph, what he's saying, that he hits them dropping into the rut of general treatment, but then he's going to say that if you do the general treatment properly,
yeah,
with a blueprint and an aim and so on, and don't get sidetracked into so-called massage,
yeah,
you will receive benefits. So he's acknowledging it to some extent anyway.
Mm. And he said the old doctor, as Andrew Slater Steele, that is again, in objecting to the treatment being given longer than necessary for adjustment alone, before our class suggested that the patient demanding a long treatment to get their money's worth should ask the dentist to take his time in extracting the tooth, or the surgeon should put in more time in removing the appendix. Oops, excuse me. So they would earn their money, which is quite an amusing anecdote.
It is, and this goes back to that same one that I was telling you earlier, of the one who said that, yes, do the adjustment, and then if you think the patient doesn't feel he's got his money's worth, then do a general treatment or give him rubbing afterwards. Mm. And it is, no, it's a, Wernham said, when he was teaching us, he almost forbade us to spend more than 20 minutes working on the patient, because after that time, the physiology started to shut down.
Mm.
And you went from actually doing physiological work to just basically manipulation, nothing else. And it's the same principle that A.T. Steele is talking about. You get the adjustment, whatever it is, done. You distribute it throughout the body. And you don't try and do too much. The patient gets tired and the treatment is lost.
And particularly in a case like this, with exhausted... patient you really have to be careful not to overdo it. I think
you have to upbuild them first. Another part of their treatment, we didn't cover everything in that, there's other bits which they talked about and which are quite in common with each other that they had here, and I'll just go through them again, because they're as is important as the mechanical, physiological, the general versus specific arguments. The Windbigler, the neurotic taint presages a mental attitude, which produces at times an excited condition with emotional manifestations or depressed condition that leads to introspection. That needs to be, the whole emotional side needs to be dealt with. Thomas Ray, we should not overlook the fact that the actions of the patient have much to do with the condition of the body. First of all, impress the patient with the great necessity for absolute cooperation. We should instruct them to take deep breathing exercises and only such foods as are known to be easily digested. Again, the whole environment comes into this. What the body, how you use the body, the type of work you're doing, the type of stresses you're putting yourself under. Right? It's impossible to tell how to treat the case, because this case means so much more than the bony lesions. And in order to understand the case, it's absolutely necessary, especially in neurasthenia, to know the individual. Pure Little John, if you like, in that, if I can use that term, you must know the patient. Wernham used to insist, get to know the patient. And you have to lead them in the direction towards health. They must be educated towards it. Ellis Still, they must sleep where there is plenty of fresh air. They must stand upright. Diet must be regulated. No overeating. Again, the whole environment is so important. And you create that environment in the treatment room to begin with, quiet, relaxed, sedate, with the patient cooperating with you. McNichol, I'd follow my first treatment with full instructions regarding general cleaning of the alimentary tract, careful regulated diet, and systematic deep breathing. In other words, get the physiology working, diet and breathing. A lot of patients don't breathe properly. McBain's, psychic influence will play on in the emotional side. And Foley, instructed at beginning to proceed in a manner of abdominal breathing, and would be required to eat such exercises as specifically tend to tone up the supports of the gavit parts and keep the luxated joints in position after they've been corrected.
This is really interesting because obviously the first section where we were looking at what these various osteopaths said was looking at more the anatomy and the physiology and the approaches that they would take. They are all looking at the environment, the patient's breathing, their beliefs, what they're eating, and they're all saying, you know, these things all have just as much influence or are really, really important influences in the patient's return to health. And so this isn't a new thing, you know, since osteopathy has introduced the biopsychosocial model, which was first coined, I think, in 1977 by Engel. You know, this is what osteopaths were doing, and this was what Andrew Taylor Still was doing and Little John was doing, you know, throughout all their years of working with people. It is, you know, it isn't something that's new. It's just something that we may have needed to refresh people's memories about.
Yeah, there's one thing that just, when you put it that way, that Still insisted on putting things in plain English, whereas sometimes we tend to show how well educated we are by putting them into complicated language.
That's very true.
Prior to this other interesting comment then, that these cases are sometimes overtreated and usually do best when given what I call the physiological dose. And that again is pure Wernham used that term so often in our training. Came straight from Little John and goes back to Andrew Taylor Still saying, you don't treat any longer than is necessary to get the adjustment done. That doesn't mean, the adjustment doesn't mean cracking something. It means getting the body to take a change, to accept what you have done and to apply it physiologically within the body. Little John used to say as well, and Wernham quoting him saying, that our treatment must be converted into the physiological equivalent. Otherwise it hasn't been, you're just a manipulator. But just enough to get a reaction and not make the patient tired or nervous. He says then, in terms of neurasthenia, he's found it very hard in case of neurasthenia because the whole nervous system is hypersensitive, very sensitive. But I saw that was a beautiful comment of the physiological dose.
Yes, it is. It is.
Right. And just to finish off that section, then I put in a little bit just about Wynn Bigler, just to just because I came across it more than anything else, and it was interesting. He went down the whole route of Christian Science and therapeutics more than osteopathy. Eventually, he came from he was a Baptist pastor, so we had expect him to take the whole emotional side, but going too far down that line to cure everything by suggestion. Anyway, it's just a little aside I thought I would throw in. So now, second part of this presentation, we come to what does Little John say about neurasthenia and how does it and his approach compare with those that we've just talked about?
There we go.
So these are taken from his practice of osteopathy. No, can we just go through them first?
Okay, so
he gives a definition.
Sorry?
He gives a definition here of what it is.
Yeah, the definition was from Little John was a condition representing deficiency of nerve force manifesting itself in sensitiveness, tenderness, irritation, especially at certain points in the spine, which vary in individual cases, and for which underlies the condition. Owing to a continued lack of assimilation, there is not normal nutrition. It is found in those disposed to or subject to other forms of neurosis, for example, in hereditary neurotism or the hysterical patient.
Okay. And the important point in that is this lack of assimilation. It's not just diet. Not just diet leading to bad nutrition within the body. It's lack of accumulation, which brings us back to those lesions in the splanchnic area that was talked about.
And the stress on the stresses in the structure increasing that input into the central nervous system, increasing the stimulation of the hypopituitary adrenal axis, inhibiting circulation to the gut as well through that splanchnic area as well as the lesions. So then you just don't digest. You could have a fantastic diet, but without there, you're not going to get it into you, are you? Here we go.
Okay, then the lesions, cervical region, upper dorsal, principally lateral lesions, displacement of ribs, intercostal muscle contraction. Causes overstrain of mind and body. Mind and body, that's the whole emotional side and the body, the whole physical, environmental, and body use side. Excessive use of stimulants like alcohol, opium, tobacco, cocaine, which is a local, including local neurasthenia, and was used by dentists back in the early 1900s. Then you have the gastric, cardiac, pulmonary disturbances, which leads to development of toxins. In the case of toxin and intoxication, more difficult to treat than from overwork. So differentiating then the primary cause of it in people, sometimes it's from overwork and stress in the environment, easier to deal with than if the patient has become toxic from intoxication and use of drugs, which have to be antidoted then, much more difficult to deal with. Lesions that maintain neurasthenia, lateral deviation, the vertebrae in the upper dorsal, twisting of the ribs, intense muscle contraction in the interscapular area. Posterior cervical vertebra maintaining the nervous system in this exhausted condition. And these lesions keep up the malnutrition of the nerve cells and fibers. Quite a list of things to think about. Mm. Not just the lesions, but the whole environment, the diet, the assimilation, the physiology.
Okay.
Symptoms. Over to you.
The patient is anemic and lacks physical and mental vigor, is easily tired. There is a regular headache here or there located. Pain in the back, moving from the lumbar, the lower part of the back upwards. This is a strong differential point. You may doubt in a woman where uterine condition of neurasthenia, if pain moves from the lower to the upper, it is neurasthenia. If in reverse, it is a uterine condition. There is an aching in the lower part of the spine, pain in the limbs always associated with abnormal heat, another differential symptom. In pelvic disturbances, aching is in the back, down the limbs with coldness of the limbs. The neurasthenic flushing of the limbs is vasomotor. Another symptom is arterial throbbing. In localized neurasthenia, we have localized throbbing. In general neurasthenia, a general throbbing. And the patient may complain that the whole surface of the body is throbbing and is crawling or creeping in the pulsation of the small arteries until they become engorged and pressed back, resulting in the late stage of neurasthenia.
That's quite an interesting in 2 points that we get. A lot of times in female patient coming in with this whole symptoms of what you call neurasthenia, where it goes back to a gynecological problem, either related to childbirth or some other trauma. I'm not saying childbirth is necessarily a trauma. And he's making a very good differential point. One is giving the symptoms similar to neurasthenia, but it isn't neurasthenia as such. It's a physiological response to a strain in the pelvic organs. Mm. And this idea, I mean, of cold limbs versus hot limbs, I mean, I've come across that myself, where you get this aching down the coldness of the limbs, you've got pelvic congestion. Mm. You get the same type of symptoms, but there's flushing in the limbs and they're feeling hot, and it's more of a neurasthenia. Mm. The nervous system itself is at the back of it.
Yeah. Mm. And sort of an interference with the relationship between deep and superficial circulation, or pelvic circulation and uterine circulation, as you're saying.
It also leads you then in more into treatment. I mean, do we look more for toxic conditions? Do we look more for environmental conditions and stress? Do we look more for emotional trauma in the patient, or do we look more for physical and physiological trauma in the patient? It leads us into thinking, how did this come about and how do we lead the patient back to health?
Okay.
And then he goes on to talk about treatment.
And say, okay, so he said the common lesions, rib lesions, constricted thoracic conditions, these lesions interrupt the intercommunication between the two great nerve systems. The normal nervous condition depends on motion and reaction. One, relax the muscles beginning from below upwards, sacral to occipital areas. Distinguishes this from all others. Then give thorough rhythmic treatment at D3-4, region to reach circulation superficial and deep and pulmonary through the heart. With the patient on their face, give strong inhibitory pressure at the side of the spinous processes, pulling up the ribs from the anterior angles against your pressure. This gives two results. A, the sympathetic chain lies anterior to the neck and pushing up the ribs opens up and relieves the sympathetic system. And B, the cerebrospinal system is stimulated through the communicating fibers and follow this by strong extension of the spine.
That should be the, I think that the sympathetic chain lies anterior to the head of the ribs.
Yes,
More
yes,
than
yeah.
anyway.
And yes, and inhibiting, trying to achieve a better balance between these the sympathetic and the cerebrospinal systems, and the overstimulation of the sympathetic system. Three, attend to any relaxed conditions associated with the eyes, ears, stomach, and viscera, etc. Springing articulation to the vertebra to stimulate the spinal cord centers. Look out for the condition of constipation and keep it relieved. And six, keep the patient free from all excitement and keep on a light, nutritious diet. Give cold sponge bath and bath and rest and change of occupation and avoid use of all stimulants and meats. In diet, use easily liquefied fat, for example, olive oil, butter, some such preparatory such as Russell's emulsion, and use no meats and plenty of water.
But in this, he's making you think not just of what you do, but why you do it and the effect it might have on the condition. He's not saying we do all of these things and every treatment, every time we see the patient. This is what we think of. We think of the supervision and deep circulation, D3, 4, 5. And that also, not just the supervision deep, but also the pulmonary through the heart, that balance of the heart and the pulmonary or circulation. And the preparatory treatment for that. Your two nervous systems, which he says is the communication between them, needs that rhythmic movement and reaction of the sympathetic chain and the cerebrospinal through the rami communicantes. As Warnham used to say, quoting again Little John, we work in that dendritic field, that field of intercommunication of the nervous system, not a fine dendritic field. That's where our manipulation leads to. And then it goes on about the constipation and so on. And then the whole environmental side, free from excitement, tone everything down, change your job if that's what the problem is, change your diet and so on. Because it getting the student to think about the condition and the patient. Then we go on to the same thing, what he says is this time taken from later notes at the BSO. And in these practice notes, treatment wasn't mentioned, but anyway, we'll go through it. It says much the same thing. So.
Yeah, it's interesting that his ideas are the same at a later time here. So he said that neurasthenia is a condition marked by deficiency of or inexercise of nerve force, manifesting itself in sensitiveness, tenderness, and irritation or irritability, marked at certain points in the spine, which vary from time to time in individual cases, depending on the underlying condition. The real basis of neurasthenia in all forms is nerve exhaustion due to continued lack of assimilation. Therefore, there is always an abnormal nutritional defect, either above or below par. It is always found in those subject to neurosis, whether from a hereditary, neurotic, constitutional, or hysterical standpoints.
Not to that he said that much more forcefully in these later notes. The whole idea of the lack of assimilation back to the treatment that he gave for the sympathetic cerebrospinal nervous system, that lids and so on.
And he says, with regard to the lesions, that they were mainly lateral in the cervical and upper dorsal regions. Accessory lesions found in the form of displaced ribs and intercostal muscles contracting. Here we find the contraction alternating between intercostal muscles in the thoracic and abdominal muscles in the of the recti. Here we go.
Go on to the exciting causes of it. Again, talking about overstrain, physical or mental, excessive use of stimulants, alcohol, tobacco, opium, and morphine. He's got the cocaine here because I think people have moved away from it, and opium is still a major, opiates, major source of intoxication. There's a huge lawsuit going on in America at the present about the opiates, and morphine. Gastric, cardiac, pulmonary interferences operating again through the development of toxic matter. In this case, it's auto-intoxication through a lesion state. And these morbid products are going to be absorbed by the nervous system. And again, he states that these toxic conditions are more difficult to cure. You know?
And you can see why that. It would be a much deeper condition then, rather than just the where he said, you know, strain from overwork or overdoing it.
And then goes on to talk again about the lesions and where they are located. Secondary to exciting causes, maintain the neurasthenia and are located lateral deviations in the vertebrae, upper D dorsal, second to fifth dorsal, twisting of the ribs, particularly 6 to 9, intense contraction of the muscles in the lower interscapular area, posterior cervical vertebra, maintaining the nervous condition of exhaustion by keeping up persistent irritation in the coordination between the brain and the spine function. And all these lesions tend to keep up malnutrition in the nerve cells and fibers. And he's covering the whole area of nutrition, assimilation, the liver as the main chemical factory, and auto-intoxication within the body. And then the symptoms.
From his later notes at the BSO, he says the patient is usually anemic and lacks physical and mental vigor, is easily tired, the latter conditions settling down in different directions, for example, asthmatic, dyspeptic conditions, biliousness, all of which represent complications from the functional side. In addition, are irregular headaches with local pains in the back. These may follow the headache, usually beginning in the lower part of the back and moving upwards. And this is the strong differential point between the general neurasthenia and a pelvic disturbance in the female. If the pain moves from the lower to the upper part of the spine, it represents neurasthenia. And if the pain is localized in the lower part as an ache and then travels towards the hip and into the legs, or if it settles in the symphysis pubic field and then travels up along the anterior abdomen, it represents distinctly pelvic pain. In neurasthenic pain, there is always a vasomotor disturbance, and therefore the seat of the disturbance is in the lower dorsal and upper lumbar, all radiating from that point. Another symptom is arterial throbbing. For example, in localized neurasthenia, there is a localized throbbing always centered in the arterial circulation. Also, in general neurasthenia, as a general throbbing developing into an extending all over the body surface. Patients will complain of crawling, stroke, creeping sensations, which represents an abnormal pulsation of small arterioles. This continues until they become engorged, and this is followed by rigidity with cramping sensation in the muscles. And these two conditions, the creeping and the crawling, are always found in the last stages of neurasthenia. In differentiating neurasthenia from kidney trouble, kidney pain always travels to the legs via the anterior thighs, whereas the pain of neurasthenia and of pelvic disturbance always travels posteriorly from the lumbar or sacral regions via the sacroiliac or cervical fields, I assume the C stands for, Chris. Going into the posterior hip field and from there down into the legs. if it does get to the legs. So it's quite a deep covering of the symptoms there, and cross-referencing with other problems.
Not every patient will have every symptom, but again,
yeah,
it's got to make you thinking differentially about what you're finding and correlating it with what the patient has. Now, on this, I mean, from these notes now, this heading at this, notes for his students. When he wrote his piece on the history of osteopathy in the Americana encyclopedia, he described his osteopathic therapeutics and so on as notes for his students, not as a textbook, not as anything, but notes for his students. Notes are there to remind you of what is said, to remind you of how to think. They're not definitive. So Little John doesn't mention pelvic or pelvic lesions in this notes that the students took for neurasthenia. And that you might see that as a criticism of Little John's approach, especially his foremost student Wernham, he laid such emphasis on the pelvis, and quoted Little John's often saying, what's the use in working on the roof if your foundations are not right, the same as we talked about before. And comparing it with what has come up with these other practitioners back in 1912, that the pelvis was always talked about. They always mentioned the pelvis in the treatment, but going back to, that's what they were asked to look at by the definition of the patient. The truth here about Little John's notes for students, I'm going to keep coming saying that, notes for students. More likely to find Little John's style of teaching. Subjects, lesionology, mechanics, physiology, and practice of osteopathy would have all been seen as dovetailing into each other. So you'd have had to have a knowledge gained from mechanics and physiology and lesionology would have been necessary foundation for the course of the practice of osteopathy and osteopathic therapeutics. So if we think of that, how are you going to treat cervical lesion in a patient? How are you going to treat that upper dorsal region, which is the breakup of the cervical dorsal arch and related to the inter-arch functions? How are you going to treat the lower dorsal region related to the pyramids? It all comes back down to the pelvis and how you integrate all of that. So all of this would have been intimately woven into these notes that you're expected to know this. So you can't go over everything in your notes on a particular illness.
No.
Bear that in mind, that a certain amount of knowledge is assumed.
Mm-hmm.
And correct a lesion doesn't mean go in and do something to it. It means taking in that whole procedure.
Mm.
I remember Wernham always talking about me coming across an L5 lesion, severe L5 lesion in a patient with a strong mechanical background in it. And he would work for maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks or more before even thinking of going anywhere near that L5 lesion, trying to get the pelvis right, taking all the other strains within the patient before going back near that acute strain.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's important that I know I'm overemphasizing it, but it's important we remember that when we're reading these notes.
Mm.
The notes give you such value in terms of how he perceives his patient, how he gets his students to think about what are the lesions? How do the lesions relate to symptoms? How does the treatment relate to addressing those symptoms and the physiology within the body?
There we go.
So just a few more notes on that. I mean, what Little John's note says, overstrain of the mind and body is one of the conditions. We'll have to deal with that. We have to deal with the cerebrospinal nervous system and the sympathetic nervous system, which means dealing with the vagus and the phrenic as a pair, dealing with the left and right sides of the body, dealing with the left and right sides of the pelvis. Common lesions, rib lesions, constricted thoracic lesions, interrupting the communication between the two great nervous systems. Again, the same point. The pain moves from the lower to the upper part of the spine is neurasthenia. You're looking at the lower dorsal, upper lumbar, the intercurrent point of the central arch. the PA line passing through the bodies of vertebrae D11 and 12. How do you reach those? You must take in that whole line of tension, the PA line, how it affects the nervous system, the breathing, the cavity pressures, and so on. How we work on that central arch, base of the pyramids, extra triangular base. The balance between the cerebrospinal and sympathetic nervous system is ingrained into that base. And disturbances of the base leads to disturbances at D4 and so on.
Hmm.
Yeah. And it's these are the things which as students we have to know and work on.
There we go.
Well, as I said, they were notes for his students. That's how he described them. And they're notes for us. And if we take the whole picture of all those osteopaths talking back then, we get a much broader picture of osteopathy as a whole, a better definition of what even back then they were thinking of as the so-called general treatment. It wasn't just willy-nilly going and giving a good massage or just taking everything and putting it through its physiological motion. Hmm. Each lesion was addressed specifically within the whole pattern of the patient and taking into account the environment, the mental state of the patient, the whole emotional state, emotional trauma, and the work environment of the patient. And this is what osteopathy is. And this is what Little John's osteopathy was. And as Little John said, his osteopathy is the osteopathy of A.T. Still.
Mm.
Right back to that.
Yeah, I think he just took A.T. Still's work, and as A.T. Still said, you know, dig on, you know, and he did, as did a lot of the other osteopaths.
Yeah, that is. I mean, we've covered that in that book on the argument between Still and Little John, which you can get from the Institute.
Mm.
There was no argument between them about physiology. Mm.
No.
They were both absolutely clear. Mm. Each treatment must be converted into a physiological equivalent to be called osteopathy.
Mm.
Otherwise, you're just a bone setter or a manipulator. Mm. Anything you want to say before finishing?
No, I think we've said enough for one day, but we have a part two coming up for this as well, where Chris is going to go through the cervical mechanics and explain a little bit more about that, aren't you?
Yes, and this was one of the ideas of this that came out for me out of this was Little John talks about these lesions. Other people talk about them by doing specific work. What does it mean and how do we go about treating a neck?
Mm.
Yeah, and that's what the part two that we'll come to shortly about. So again, thank you all for listening.
Thank you very much for taking the time for listening, and thank you for your time, Chris. If anyone would like any more information about classical osteopathy, please go to the Institute of Classical Osteopathy website, which is www.classical-osteopathy.org. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Bye.